John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The shifting of populations in times of conflict. That's our theme this hour in an unusual portfolio of stories from the U.S. to Ukraine, from the current moment to looking back two decades in Rwanda, where a population declared war on itself with repercussions still being felt today. We'll also lighten things up a bit this hour by thinking about the adolescent dramas of high school and hear some of your stories about how tough growing up can be. We'll have a look at flying dinosaurs. Oops, pterosaurs. We'll explain the difference a little later this hour. But we begin with what some in Moscow would have us believe are rival populations of Ukrainians and Russians. Is the crisis in Ukraine escalating into a possible pretext for Russian military action? Russian nationalist demonstrators are at the barricades in the pro-Russian Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. Here's the deputy Ukrainian foreign minister, Danilo Lubkivsky, speaking about the situation to the BBC.
We have received reports that clearly show that the situation remains dangerous, but so far, it is taken under control, and we have some positive changes in the situation. First of all, the buildings of our local authorities, Kharkiv and other cities, have been released. So those groups of provocateurs and pro-Russian-oriented manifestators have been located, and the general situation is under control.
Despite claims that the situation is under control, Ukraine's security forces are continuing to confront demonstrators in what it is calling, quote, an anti-terrorist operation. In reaction, there have been stern warnings to the Ukrainian government from Moscow that the use of violence against the demonstrators could result in an all-out civil war. We're joined now by Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Professor, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So all of these warnings and actions and flames in the square there in Kharkiv symbolize the tensions really behind the scenes. This is about more than just a couple of demonstrations.
It's not just Kharkiv either. It's also Donetsk and Luhansk, and there is violence elsewhere happening in Ukraine. It's especially disturbing because the pro-Russian demonstrators have not merely been taking over government buildings. They've also been taking over security force, Ukrainian security force buildings, and have been taking the weapons from those buildings. And so we know that, for example, in Luhansk, another of the eastern cities in Ukraine, they are still inside the security services building, and the security services building has an arsenal of 300 machine guns. And so that means presumably they have access to those guns.
How are we in the West? And I'll distinguish between persons like myself and then policymakers like John Kerry. How are we to distinguish between people who believe that Vladimir Putin has given them a kind of green light, I don't care what you do, for violence inside Ukraine versus actually instigating and being a part of a plot? Is there much of a difference at this point?
Well, it's really difficult to tell exactly who is doing what and for what motives, but we do know that in Donetsk, another one of the cities in eastern Ukraine, when the people first came into the city and demanded to see the mayor, they were asking for the mayor and trying to storm the opera house because they didn't know the difference between the opera house and the regional government building. And that would indicate that at best, they are not actually Donetsk residents who have lived there for a long time and know where's what in the city. One of the reporters who was on the scene there said that one of the people admitted to coming from Crimea. And so it's not clear that people are coming necessarily directly from Russia, but it does appear that they are coming from Crimea into eastern Ukraine to try to agitate on behalf of things that are not really local interests.
Kimberly Martin, let's step back for a moment. In the recent history, in the last half century of history in this part of the world, particularly in Ukraine, there's been a significant movement of populations. Who is an actual local, who is associated with a particular region and a city? Sometimes that can be difficult to determine, even if specifically people are coming in from Crimea and Moscow. Can you sketch out what the history has been over the last half century?
Oh, the last half century is, if you go just a little bit beyond the last half century, it is so complex because the borders have changed so many times. Up until World War II broke out, the territory that is now Ukraine was divided between what was then the early days of the Soviet Union on the one side and an attempt at a reconstituted Poland on the other side. But even just a few decades before that, it had been split between multiple empires, with part of it being long-term in the Russian Empire, another part being long-term in the Habsburg Empire. So, I mean, going back in history, the population movements have been incredible. And then, of course, in Soviet times, there wasn't really a distinction between Ukraine and Russia and Moldova and Belarus and any of these other areas that are now separate countries. They were all just republics within the Soviet Union. And so people would go from one place to another, depending on where the jobs and where the industries were. And so there's been just an immense amount of population change over time. What we do know is that the last time that a Ukrainian census was taken, which was back in 2001, they probably haven't dared to take one since then because of how explosive the ethnic situation could potentially be. But in 2001, we know that throughout these eastern cities in Ukraine, the level of the population who identified themselves as being ethnically Russian was somewhere in the high 30%. So like 37, 38% of the population in these cities identified as being ethnically Russian, with the majority identifying as being ethnically Ukrainian.
And that, while not a majority, is a sizable enough fraction of the population to create the kinds of instabilities that we are seeing if people Yes. feel threatened or feel emboldened to take to the streets.
And the thing is, it would be very unusual for people to actually feel threatened because there has not been any threatening activity that has come from the government in Kyiv to these areas. It's all based on a sense of rumors, you know, maybe fears about what might happen in the future. Certainly there are Ukrainian nationalist groups who are a very small minority who are violent, but they have not really taken out violence against Russians for being Russian. And so it appears that if there are fears, the fears have been artificially stoked. It's not that something has happened that has caused people to feel threatened.
But would you say as the weeks go on here, I mean, the Russians claim that the change of government in Kyiv was the result of a coup. They're continuing to call it a coup against Yanukovych. As time goes on, can Russia more credibly make the case that this constitutes some sort of crackdown against Russian nationalists? And what would you say the Ukrainian government needs right now from the West and from other allies in Europe to maintain its territorial integrity and legitimacy in the eyes of the world?
Well, that's a very complex set of questions that you've just asked there, John. So let's go back to the one about the coup. What actually happened is that the former leader, Yanukovych, decided to flee the country, and he fled the country after his own forces had fired on demonstrators. And there had been violence on both sides as the demonstrations progressed in January and February. But it's important to remember that the first step in all of this that really caused things to unravel was Yanukovych's police forces, his special police operations forces, firing on protesters who were peaceful. And so that's where everything began back in the fall. And it was at that point, when the original protests were about joining Europe and were peaceful, that the forces coming from the then Ukrainian government fired on those protesters and carried out violence against those protesters. And that's what caused the protests to massively scale up in size. And at that point, the protesters were not agitating on behalf of joining Europe. They were agitating against the human rights violations and against the violence that was being practiced by the Ukrainian regime. But there really wasn't a coup. What happened was that Yanukovych fled the country, and at that point, the legislature that had been freely and fairly elected, as much as you can talk about free and fair elections, because they were the same kinds of elections that brought in the president who fled, but the people who had been elected, the legislature in the country, the parliament in the country, was the one who took over. And that there was nobody really else who could have taken over. And so calling it a coup is being disingenuous. It was an ambiguous situation. But what happened, the takeover that did happen, was with the people who were left in the country, who were the most legitimate force that you could possibly think of as being left in the country. Now, in terms of what Ukraine needs to protect its territorial integrity, I'm not sure it's going to get it. What Ukraine would need to protect its territorial integrity is military support. support coming from NATO. And that's not going to happen. Ukraine is not a NATO member. NATO has no interest in getting militarily involved in the situation. And the truth is that Russian security forces, Russian military forces are strong enough that if Russia decided to come over the border, they would find themselves enmeshed in a civil war. It would not be an easy thing, but they could, with fighting, manage to control all of Ukraine. They would then find themselves fighting a massive insurgency, a massive guerrilla campaign probably coming from the Ukrainians. But there really is nothing physically that the Ukrainians can do to stop the Russians from doing that. And so the situation that the Ukrainians find themselves in is just trying to negotiate, trying to figure out if there's some way to convince Russia not to go in. But they're not going to get what they would need from the West to stop Russia from going in.
You characterized Vladimir Putin's accusation that it was a coup that changed the government in Kiev as disingenuous when the Russians say more violence will cause civil war. I mean, those are pretty frightening words.
That's also disingenuous, because what's provoking everything is the support that's coming from Russian territory and now from Russian-occupied Crimea. And the people who are taking over these government buildings are stealing weapons and are acting violently. And so to claim that somehow it's Ukraine that's provoking this is a lie. It is just turning things on its head. And it's the kind of thing that we would expect somebody who is a KGB operative, which is what Putin's background is. He is very good at using information campaigns. He always has been. And it's an information campaign. But I think it's important to sort out what the truth is. The situation is obviously ambiguous, but so far it's not the Ukrainian government that's using force. It's these people who are calling themselves pro-Russian protesters, but who don't know where their own regional government building is in the city of Donetsk, who are probably following the same pattern of what happened in Crimea, which is that it was not locals who were doing it. It was people coming over from the Russian side who were essentially KGB operatives or, in some cases, even special operations forces who came in civilian clothes and then turned out to have some form of military uniforms hidden. So, I mean, this is Russia that's doing this. This is not people who are just frightened Russian-speaking citizens of the eastern Ukrainian areas.
Helping to clarify the complicated situation in Ukraine right now, Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me back.
This week, we are starting a conversation about the challenges of growing up and learning when to step up and when to hold back in high school. The high school pecking order of jocks and cheerleaders, nerds and dweebs, mean girls, brains and bullies.
The sportos and motorheads, bloods, wastoids.
It's brutal up there at the top.
What's much more common is conflict among kids who are high status. They're kind of jockeying for a position as popular kids, and they're going after each other.
Writer and Slate editor Emily Bazelon joins us tomorrow to talk about the pressures and complexity of high school and why we all remember who it was that was mean to us back in the day, or who we were mean to.
Hi, this is Kimberly Griffin from Detroit. I would apologize to all of my uncool, nerdy, weird classmates for having excluded them from my friendship circle just because I perceived them as being different. They were way more cool than I was mature enough to realize back then.
Well, Kimberly got something off her chest from Portland, Oregon. I would apologize to everyone. I'm fairly certain I was a pompous ass when I was in high school. I was masking my teenage insecurity. Who do you need to settle with from your mean high school days, or who needs to settle with you? We'd love to hear your story. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Now a story of population transfer happening right here in America. Only in America, we've been calling it deportation.
We focused and used discretion about whom to prosecute, focusing on criminals who endanger our communities rather than students who are earning their education. And today, deportation of criminals is up 80%. We've improved on that discretion carefully and thoughtfully.
President Barack Obama told the nation back in 2012 that he was modifying his administration's deportation policy for illegal immigrants to focus only on violent offenders. But according to an investigation in the New York Times, of the 2 million deportations that have been carried out under President Obama, Two-thirds of the cases involve individuals who committed only minor infractions or had no criminal record at all. This is the case for Elizabeth Perez, a former Marine and mother of two, whose husband Marcos was deported to Mexico in 2010 after he was pulled over for running a red light. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you, John, and I would also like to say thank you for giving me this opportunity from the hundreds of thousands of families in this situation that I'm able to speak with you today.
Let's talk about the situation. And the president would have us believe that the only people being deported are being deported for very serious criminal violations and that family considerations are being taken into account. That's absolutely not the case for you. Explain.
No, John, that's actually completely not the case. The fact that I was pregnant when my husband was deported and we have our first son was 4 months old, none of that was taken into consideration.
And you're a former Marine yourself.
Yes.
So the idea that you're doing anything other than supporting the United States of America is absurd on its face.
Exactly, John. I'm a very patriotic woman. I love my country. I love everything about my country, our culture, the food, everything. And being in the Marine Corps, I'm very familiar with the processes of bureaucracy and paperwork and getting things filled out. So I understood that with my husband's situation, it wasn't going to be really fast. But I was completely, completely shocked that the way it actually is, that he has no chance of coming back. I didn't realize that. I thought we do the right thing. We fill out the papers. We do the process. And in the end, it's going to be okay.
Do you remember the traffic violation that began everything, that set everything in motion?
Yes, I remember. It was the very day I told my husband that I was pregnant with our second child. And he went to work and he was pulled over by the police for running a red or yellow light. The police officer actually called me on the phone at the traffic stop to ask me questions. Who is this man? What's his social security number? Where does he live? Asking me all these questions on the phone. And he said he can't identify him and he was going to call immigration and immigration could identify him. I was like, you don't have to do that, sir. And he was like, yes, I do. And for some reason, at that very second, my phone just died. So I don't know if they thought I hung up and I had to walk to the police station with my 4-month-old child to try to figure out what was going on. And that was it.
What are your options at this point? And I'm assuming going to Mexico to join your husband might be one of them.
Well, I have been to Mexico a couple summers. I've gone, and it's not been easy there. We've had a really hard time financially. There's a whole lot of other issues, safety issues. Our options are very slim right now. I could either move to Mexico, but why should I have to be exiled from my country? I love my country. I spent 10 years for my country. Why should I have to leave to Mexico and take my U.S. citizen sons with me to go to Mexico? I'm not Mexican. I'm American. I want to be here in America. So we have that option where I can just be exiled. Or we have the option of we can try to find another country to move to. Or then there's the third option that a lot of people do. Unfortunately, they try to cross the border and come back. But I don't want my husband dead or thrown in prison. So those are our three options. And until I was in a very dark place after 2.5 years, we went through the visa interview. And when he was denied the visa interview until 2020 is when they said he can apply for a visa, 2020. I fell into like a deep state of depression and everything. And I'm taking care of our children by ourselves. And that's when I came into contact with the group OLA. And basically, I think of them as like footprints in the sand. They picked me up, carried to me where I am now. And I feel like fighting and going through the democratic process, we can change the law and then my husband can come back. So those are the four options. Change the law, exiled to Mexico, we move to another country, or he risks death or prison to come back here to be with his children.
Wow. I have to say, you know, you make your case and somebody certainly got you motivated again. That depression is definitely in your rear view right now. What do your kids think is going on?
My kids think my husband is the telephone and they think my husband is we use Skype. So on their birthdays, I have to set up Skype and put the computer in front of the birthday cake so we can all be together. Every night I talk to my husband every day a couple times. Because I want him involved in everything, even if it's just by the phone. So at nighttime when my children say their prayers and I read them a story. He's right there with us on the phone, but it's honestly kind of awkward. And we go to Mexico every summer and we spend the summer with him, but it's like ripping off a Band-Aid, because when we come back, they're very attached to him. They love him. It's their father. They're very attached to him. And it's very difficult for me to watch them when we come back here. And, you know, when I discipline them, they cry for him. When they fall down and get hurt, they don't say, mommy, mommy. They cry. They say, daddy. And that's really, it really hurts me inside as their mother to, you know that I'm trying so hard to get him to come back here, but there's not a lot of avenues unless the law changes and we see what's going on with that. There's nothing we can really do right now, or we have to, you know, like I said earlier, be exiled from our own country.
What's your message to Congress? What's your message to the president?
My message to Congress and my message to the president is wake up. Stop this nonsense. Stop bickering between each other. There's people's lives at stake here. Honest, good, dedicated, patriotic people. This isn't just an issue of immigrants, and it's spilling into American blended families, everything. Like, wake up. These are human beings, people, children without their father. I had to go on to government subsidies to help me live economically because my husband was deported, and he was the only one working because I just had a baby and I was pregnant again. So it's like there's so many other things people are going through with this, and it's just really sad that nobody can just wake up and just work together and let's fix this and help people.
Elizabeth Perez, 35-year-old, former Marine, mother of two, husband was deported after a traffic violation in 2010. Elizabeth, thanks so much and good luck.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com.
A moment ago, we heard the pleas of a mother, Elizabeth Perez, trying to hold her family together despite the chaotic policy of deportations under the Obama administration and the lack of a policy nationwide for immigration reform. For decades, Democratic Congressman from Illinois, Luis Gutierrez, has been trying to deliver immigration reform. He hears the pleas of moms like Elizabeth Perez every single day.
It seems to me that we're at a point of no return on the issue of deportations and our immigration policy. Come July of this year, one of two things is going to happen. Number one, the Republicans will finally come to their senses in the House of Representatives and sit down with Democrats and craft bipartisan immigration legislation. We'll pass it. And we'll send it to the president's desk for a signature. And if they don't do that, if they refuse to do that, then I think the president of the United States has only one alternative. He will become the sole voice for those of us who want to see this, the deportation sent and the devastating effect on American families end by signing one executive order after another. And let me just make clear to all of your radio listeners is that the president has the authority already.
Congressman Gutierrez, is the president a credible voice there with his executive orders? He led us to believe in 2012 that the policy of deportations had changed and that people would not be deported for traffic violations, only violent offenses. But the New York Times shows, and Elizabeth Perez's case is one of them, that in fact most of the people being deported are caught in these trivial offenses.
Now, look, that happened. We have challenged him. I've been taken away twice in handcuffs from in front of the White House with others denouncing the deportations of families and the separation of families. So we've had this argument, but I just want to go back to one thing. And what I originally spoke to you about, John, is that, look, it's coming. The House Republicans will either give us a bill or the president will sign one executive order. Now, I met with them 3 weeks ago. Now, here's the difference. Every time in the past, we went and spoke to Barack Obama and we challenged his homeland security, they would tell us there's nothing we can do. We're only deporting criminals and there's nothing else we can do. Well, I met with him 3 weeks ago, and as you know, He didn't say there's nothing more we can do. He ordered a complete review of the deportation processes. I met with Secretary Johnson of Homeland Security 2 weeks ago. And tomorrow, the Hispanic Congressional Caucus, all of us, will meet with Secretary Johnson. We have a memorandum for him, a memorandum which was posted already in different news media, including the Washington Post. It's a 6-page, detailed, affirmative actions that the president can take to put families in a safe place.
I want to push you on this, though, Congressman Gutierrez. What would you describe this transfer of 2 million people through the deportations policy? Is it an administrative glitch? Is it a political stalemate? Is it a population transfer? Is it ethnic cleansing? How close does it come?
I can tell you what it has cost. I have traveled to dozens of cities, whether they're in fields or in meatpacking plants or in community churches across this country. There is a palpable fear. People move constantly. Every day it's 1,100 people. So, look, we knew this. It's had a devastating effect on our community. And you know what? The elected officials here, the members of Congress, many of whom didn't want to take the president on year in and year out, are now taking him on. Nancy Pelosi said it's un-American what's happening. It's time for a change. It's so redundant when it comes to Barack Obama. But really, I believe that he does not want to go down in history as deporter-in-chief. That's not where he wants to be. There are bad, mean, nasty people in the immigrant community that are foreigners that do damage to us. Let's prioritize them and put all of the resources of the immigration forces to get rid of them out of our country and make our community safe.
Well, Congressman Gutierrez, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Fourth District Democratic Congressman from the state of Illinois, Representative Luis Gutierrez. In a moment, the scars from Rwanda's genocide 20 years after the killing began. But first, there's a quieter trend dividing neighbor from neighbor that is sweeping Africa. More than 30 nations worldwide have declared that homosexuality is a crime. Most of those nations are in Africa. This weekend, I was part of a panel about the expansion of anti-gay laws in Uganda and Nigeria, part of the annual Women in the World Summit, hosted in New York City by Tina Brown. In Nigeria, persons found in a same-sex union can be thrown in jail for 14 years under a new law passed this year. While just a few weeks ago, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni passed an anti-homosexuality act, allowing those convicted of homosexuality to be imprisoned for life. In the 2013 documentary God Loves Uganda, filmmaker Roger Ross Williams tells the story of how American evangelicals have fanned the flames of intolerance in Africa.
The government is the government, and they have a responsibility to do what they want to do. Right now, the law says no homosexuality in this nation. God, it's an abomination to God. And I will stand in agreement that they should not open the doors, because God doesn't want it. He wants it stopped.
Two women on stage at the summit this weekend felt personally targeted by these new laws in Uganda and Nigeria. Adejoke Tubiele is a Nigerian-American artist and filmmaker who has come out publicly in defiance of the law, while Ugandan activist Claire Biarugaba was outed by Christian vigilantes in her country, where she now fears for her life. Both describe the difference being out as a gay person in America versus being out in their own countries.
Being out in Uganda means you face 7 years to life imprisonment simply because you've declared that you're lesbian, gay, or bisexual, transgender, or intersex. I've at a personal level received so many death threats. I've had so many issues with the family. All our work is basically in danger because we are reviewed and accused of promotion of homosexuality. So it is very difficult back home at the moment.
Explore that promotion of homosexuality idea, because the law doesn't simply say that the way you go about your life is illegal. It says that to be you is essentially to be a member of a group that's trying to undermine your own homeland, right?
Yes. My lifestyle is very legal. My work is very legal. The idea is that the government thinks we are after promoting homosexuality. What that means to them is that we're going to schools promoting homosexuality. Through our work, we're raising awareness, very important awareness about the issue of homosexuality.
If we were in Uganda, you would be arrested now for doing exactly what you're doing.
I would be arrested and sentenced to 7 years in jail.
Ade. The experience is similar for you. What's it like to be out in Uganda versus what's it like to be out in a place like New York or London?
here. You're free to walk about, interact with people, work in organizations. In my case, I'm an artist. But in Nigeria, it's a very different story. Since the signing of the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act, which is really a mask law that is very, very harsh and anti-gay, as it loops in many other things such as no hand-holding and no meetings of gays. You know, there's a lot of fear. Even worse so, Nigeria is a place where people take the law into their own hands. So there's always this idea of, you know, if you're out in public being attacked by mob violence, which we have seen happen already. And then on a very personal scale, not being able to just be free. There's fear of being homeless and not being able to get a job, apart from just the fear of death.
So faced with all of that, what possessed you to come out on CNN in front of the entire world?
Yes, I had the opportunity to say no, but I also felt I was in a position of responsibility. It seemed to me that if I didn't take the opportunity, then what was I living for or even working for? And that, you know, here's an opportunity to help other lesbians in Nigeria become more visible or have their issues become more visible. So I took the opportunity.
Voices there of Claire Biarugaba with the Civil Society Coalition on Human Rights and Constitutional Law, and Adejoke Tubiele, a Nigerian-American artist and filmmaker with the Solidarity Alliance for Human Rights.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When the genocide began in Rwanda 20 years ago this week, a population divided and began a slaughter that went on for months until hundreds of thousands of people were dead. 22-year-old Eugenie Mukeshimana did not die, but she came close many times before she was able to escape Rwanda. 20 years later, she lives in Newark, New Jersey, and helps immigrant genocide survivors deal with the still vivid scars from two decades ago, vivid like Eugenie Mukeshimana's own memories of exactly when she knew everything had changed.
When the people showed up at the doorsteps and they said, you need to come out, you are Tutsis and we have to kill you. I was 8 months pregnant, and we have been living in Kigali, and we have been experiencing insecurities. But at that time, I think most of us have been feeling that the country was going to have peace because the peace accord agreement were about to be signed. The UN was there. The RPF soldiers were there. We kind of didn't see it coming.
When that plane went down with the leaders of Rwanda, did you know what would happen? Or even then, it wasn't clear?
Personally, I thought it was a military coup in that eventually there will be people who will be killed, people with political aspirations. But I didn't expect it to turn into killing of everyone, poor, rich, everyone pretty much indiscriminately.
Can you recall the tone on the radio stations that called people to this violence and terrified them?
Oh, my God. The radio station had been very popular because it had been able to entertain people with hatred messages. And the tone was telling them that it's okay to go out and kill the neighbors, and they will be doing a duty that is expected of them.
Do you remember someone who you knew as a neighbor, or possibly even as a friend, an acquaintance, who was changed by that call?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I knew one family that we went to seek refuge the very first night, and the husband had changed completely. The wife was willing to help, but the husband said no, and that man was a friend of ours. But I also later on learned that my own classmates and neighbors and the kids I grew up playing soccer with have all participated in the killing.
How did you survive?
Luck. I was brought to a killing site, and I was the first one brought there. This was Arimei. They have, at this point, run out of people to kill almost. Because I was the first one at the killing site, apparently I was in such bad shape that they didn't think I should be the one to start off the day with. So they made me sit and wait for a better-looking victim, and that sort of like saved my life.
8 months pregnant.
That actually happened after
really?
I had the baby.
So where's the baby now?
She's almost 20.
Wow.
She's in college.
What do you
freshman.
Tell her? What do you tell her about those days?
We don't talk about it, but she grew up with it. When she was little, we went to funerals, and when we came to America about 12 years ago, I remember that she saw a book. It was a book about the killing field in Cambodia. Mm. And she saw some pictures, and she asked if her dad had been killed that way. So I knew then, she was almost 8, that she understood a little bit about what had happened.
What are the issues that people hold on to that stay with them from an event like this that you have to deal with in your survivor support network?
The memories that don't fade away. And sometimes also the good memories that are fading away. I have one survivor who, he was a child, but he remembers the clothes that his mother used to wear, but he's having a hard time really retaining the image of the mother. Like, what did her eyes look like? What about the hands, the hair?
It's hard enough being an immigrant in the United States if you didn't go through a genocide 20 years ago. How do you think this survivor experience complicates what would otherwise be a very difficult, challenging process of being an immigrant in the United States?
Well, the reason of policy to allow people to immigrate here just very easily. Some people who come here and they end up staying, they have to apply for asylum. And the process is not easy when the system pretty much wants you to remember every single day mm-hmm. what happened. What time was it? What clothes were they wearing? What about the shoes? And it's very difficult to recount what happened. And sometimes there are black holes in the memory. Some people remember the beginning. The whole middle of the genocide is just not there. So it's impossible to navigate the system by yourself. And that's why I do what I do. I help them find legal representation so that that process can be easy on them.
Eugenie, you've talked so much about memory. I wonder if in closing I could ask you, is there a memory you wish you could forget even today and a memory that you wish you could get back that you may have forgotten in the last 20 years?
Well, what we lost during the genocide and after the genocide, we're still discovering. It recently became clear to me that even though my daughter and I are talking about going to Rwanda, the image that I have of a village where I grew up and the home and everything that was there, the farm, the animals, nothing is there. So she's going to miss out of what life was like and the friends and the birthdays that never happened, the weddings and never happened to a lot of people. So home is home. There are good memories that I have of that time, but also mixed up with other memories. It's impossible to separate the two.
Eugenie Mukeshimana was 22 years old when the Rwandan genocide began. Her daughter is?
She's turning 20 on May 8th.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for being here.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Eugenie Mukeshimana is founder and executive director of the Genocide Survivors Support Network in Newark, New Jersey.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Sometimes in the early days of April, when winter is reluctant to give up its grip and you yearn for something a little more spring-like, you can get a huge dose of spring by coming to the Butterfly Conservatory. They have them all over the United States. But this one here at the American Museum of Natural History is a place to go and be surrounded by flying creatures that evolved on our planet millions and millions of years ago. Butterflies.
This one is called an owl butterfly because it has these eye spots.
Oh, look at it on his head.
Oh, gosh.
Guys.
Now, most of the exhibits and rock fossils at the famous Natural History Museum don't move. But just upstairs from the butterflies, there are some flying fossils. Hey, that's me, a fossilized radio host.
Oh, boy, I'm going to die there. Yep. All right, so I keep myself back, flap a little bit, maybe get a little altitude here. All right, let's come down and see if we can get a fish.
I'm flying over a Triassic landscape in a really cool pterosaur simulator where you can experience flight from the perspective of a flying reptile, a pterosaur. If you call them dinosaurs here at this exhibit, you will get a talking to from Dr. Mark Norell, chair of the museum's Division of Paleontology, and Dr. Alexander Kellner, an associate professor at the Museo Nacional in Brazil. Forget dinosaurs here, they say. Dr. Kellner, in particular, has spent his life looking at these 60 to 200 million-year-old winged fossils.
It's definitely my life's work. I wanted to study pterosaurs when I was really a kid. I didn't even know the name pterosaur. I was also very, very lucky because when I started my career as a geologist at the Federal University in Rio, I came across some bones. And I remember when I was bringing those bones to the professor, to paleontology professor at the time, he kind of said, oh, those could be mosasaurs, which are marine reptiles. And I said, yeah, sure. They could be dinosaurs. And said, yeah, great. But when he said they could be pterosaurs, my eyes just cut, you know. I was very excited about it. And after that, I met the most important vertebrate paleontologist at that time in Brazil, Jorge Almeida Campos. And in less than 2 seconds, he told me, those are pterosaurs. And I was already fascinated. How does he know? Now I know. It's because of the thickness of the bone. They're very thin, bald bones. So,
just their bones are so fragile that they make really bad fossils. The typically things that have, you know, big teeth or very hard bones, they make good fossils. But pterosaurs, even the giant pterosaurs, would have bones that are only a couple millimeters thick, so that they're broken up and destroyed really quickly.
The learning that will take place at this exhibit, I mean, it's certainly about what are pterosaurs, but it's also what are they not? What are pterosaurs not?
Pterosaurs are not dinosaurs. They're closely related to dinosaurs, but each one went their own evolutionary path. So that's one of the things. They are reptiles, they're flying reptiles that are closely related with dinosaurs, but they are a group on its own.
The kind of confusing thing about it all is that people say, well, what is the closest living relative of pterosaurs? And it's birds, because birds are a kind of dinosaur. But flight is totally independent in each group, and the way in which the architecture of the wing, everything else, is completely different.
What did they eat? How did they compete with the huge dinosaurs that we know from, you know, all the movies and growing up as a kid and having the little plastic models?
I mean, we know some were plant eaters. We know some ate fish. We know that some were insect eaters, for instance. So just like birds have varied diets today, these animals would have also.
There are very few specimens with stomach content. So we infer that based on their teeth, on their skull. So, for example, the insect-eating dinosaurs that Mark was just mentioning, like Eholopterus, they tend to have a very broad skull with very few teeth. But if you see Pterodaustro, which is a pterosaur from Argentina, that has very filamentous teeth, very, very many, many hundreds of teeth, and so it was eating very similar, in a similar way like flamingos do today.
So Velociraptor, that's familiar. Yeah. Tyrannosaurus, of course, that's familiar. Give me the species names for some of your favorite pterosaurs, Alex.
It's very difficult actually to pick, but I would say that one of the most interesting ones from Brazil would be Thalassodromus, which is portrayed in a diorama in this exhibit. And from America would be Don Draco. We have this really very, very nice cast of this almost complete pterosaur from North America.
Was it an advantage for them evolutionarily? Pterosaurs to be able to fly?
Oh, definitely. I mean, because it's just why birds are so diverse. It's just that all of a sudden you're able to fly, it opens up a whole new set of different ecologic opportunities to be of things to eat, of availability of food, of the availability to travel over long distances. So the origin of flight is pretty unique, and that's the reason that, you know, if we look at birds today, that there's at least 10,000 different species of birds. That's over twice the number of species of mammals that are in existence. But even of mammals, the most diverse group of mammals is bats, and they're able to fly.
And I would like to add to that, if you think about the evolutionary history of pterosaurs, so far we know something around 200 named species, of which some around 150 are considered valid. And the time period that they lived is roughly around 160 million years, so you have only about one species each million year. So this tells us that there have been much more pterosaurs around that we don't know of yet.
So could you guys recreate, before we go, the debates that are going on in the pterosaur community, the famous bipedal, quadrupedal? That one's over. What are the debates today? What are the arguments today?
Most of the debates now are how they took off is a big one. Another debate is that how far they could fly without sitting back down again. The only real way to figure out what something ate is to find a dead one with something inside of it. So all these other inferences that we make about pterosaurs on the basis of that their teeth, their jaws, their musculature are just inferences. And there's a lot of disagreement about what some of these animals ate. So it comes down to basic ecological kinds of things.
And one other is how actually they look like externally. We have found some pterosaurs that show some fibers, which we are calling pycnofibers. Pterosaur hair on the quotation mark. And if I could make a wish, what would I like to find? And that would be a small, tiny piece of pterosaur preserved in amber that would give us so much information about those creatures that would be really tremendously interesting.
So you're looking for pterosaur lint.
Yeah.
That would change your life. Where do you come down on the pterosaur fur thing? Do you think for sure? Is it completely made up? Do you guys agree on this?
I think 100%. We have great fossils that have that way. And some people would say, well, how do you know they all had it that way? Well, for 99% of all the, more than 99% of all the fossil mammals that have ever been found, there's been no hair found on them. But you don't have a problem putting hair on them because other mammals have hair. Well, the best preserved pterosaur fossils we have preserve these pycnofibrils, which I think are the homologous to feathers, but Alex and I disagree on that.
But
at the same time.
But we have a way to resolve it, Mark, and yeah. I just pointed out to him, we just need to take those so-called protofeathers, put them through a scanning electron microscope or trying to find different ways, do the same with pterosaurs, and then we would know.
So we're just externally, one grant for an electron microscope study.
Yeah. Anyway, this would be an interesting thing. Okay, let's do it, Mark.
That's Alexander Kellner, an associate professor at the Museu Nacional in Brazil, and Dr. Mark Norell, chair of the museum's Division of Paleontology. They were gracious enough to give us a tour of the Pterosaurs, Flight in the Age of Dinosaurs exhibit at the Natural History Museum here in New York. It will be on view until January 4th of 2015. Now, I'm thinking the pterosaurs developed wings because they were being bullied by nasty dinosaurs. Paleo-bullying. Tomorrow, neo-bullying will be our focus. We'll explore the stresses in high school from the top to the bottom of the food chain. Is there anyone you'd want to apologize to or get an apology from all these years later? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.